Welcome to the University of Nottingham podcast.
Well, this week we really are keeping the financial crisis in mind with Dr. Robert Hoffman. Dr. Hoffman and his colleagues specialise in the psychology of business, and that influences the decisions we make, good and bad. Now, you'll hear why he thinks that, to a large extent, we've been talked into recession.
Media people should be more aware of these things, of the impact they do have.
Why you as an individual really are bigger than the bank.
All the actions of individuals together create something which is often much bigger than the sum of the parts.
And the Chinese perspective.
Potentially, they think they're more insulated from these effects. But of course, at the moment, China's economic growth is mainly generated by firms exporting, especially consumer goods, to the West.
I think just starting off really with the idea of psychology in the economy, perhaps looking at Gordon Brown's comments about the fact that it will be difficult, but these will be the birth pangs of a new global order. Clearly psychology is important.
Yeah, often I think psychological processes are not really taken seriously enough in analysing global phenomena or even national phenomena, because it doesn't seem important how one person acts. But actually how one person acts is incredibly important, because all the actions of individuals together create something which is often much bigger than the sum of the parts.
Now, we've seen that with Alistair Darling, accused of talking the economy down not so long ago. We're obviously clearly in a very tangible mess at the moment, globally. But how much of that have we done to ourselves? Have we actually talked ourselves into this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a number of theories which suggest that issue of self-confirming hypotheses. If consumers believe the situation will be bad and the economy will be bad, then this will be self-confirming. Consumers will stop buying, firms will stop hiring, and people make less income, and therefore the whole thing becomes a spiral. And I personally believe often coverage in the press can lead to these things and probably make the situation worse rather than better.
As far as your own work, what areas are you focusing on?
Well, my background is actually as an economist, and one part of economics is looking at how individuals make decisions, and it's trying to explain macroeconomic phenomena, such for instance the financial crisis, with respect to individual behavior. But traditionally, economists assume that people are rational in some sense, which means that they use information in the best possible way. They calculate in some way the best possible things for them to do. But now we know from psychology that, in fact, people are often not capable of doing this. They don't have the information. They cannot process it. So therefore, as economists now, we often study well-known psychological processes and see how they have impacts on economic decision-making. And very basically, people often misunderstand information and then are capable of producing errors in their decision-making. On the other hand, of course, sometimes people are very good at making decisions psychologically. For instance, they will use something called heuristics, or routines and procedures, which all of us use in our daily lives. And those sometimes simplify the information that you get, but come up with very, very good decisions. But the downside is sometimes, as we can see in the financial crisis, that if lots of us make imperfect decisions, then there could be global results which are negative on the whole.
How do you use psychology to help, not necessarily fix the problem, but certainly help facilitate this global new order?
Yes. That Gordon Brown keeps talking. Short of regulating the media, which of course no sane person.
Well, you know, that would be a good start. But
I think the first thing I would say is I think media people should be more aware of these things, of the impact they do have. But secondly, I think, and there was a number of people who've now gone public basically saying, let's all calm down. It is not as bad as we think, and we're going to talk ourselves into it. And these kinds of voices ought to be listened to more and reported more. And I think often individual journalists should be more responsible and think, well, it's not simply selling more copy. It's also about what impact do I have being here on Radio 4, for instance, on people out there. And those things should be taken more seriously, I think.
Now, you're opening a new centre in our campus in China, exploring these issues.
As we said, it's called the International Centre of Behavioural Business Research. And actually, it's located in all three campuses, which is why we have the I in the ICBBR, which means it's actually located here in Nottingham, at the China campus and at the campus in Malaysia. And we have active members in all three locations. And essentially, the ethos behind it is very, very simple. We are not just economists. People from all business disciplines, including marketing, strategy, information systems, and so on and so forth, all sharing the ideal of looking at psychological mechanisms to analyze decision-making, because we think it is individual decision-making which causes these kinds of business and economic phenomena that we're interested in.
The issue from the Chinese perspective must be quite interesting. I mean, what are they saying over there?
China's a bit different. We recently had a talk by a professor actually from Nottingham, Professor Yao, who's a Chinese national, and he came and gave a very well-received talk on the financial crisis and the impact in China. And interestingly, and this fits in well with our center, the International Center for Behavioral Business Research, because he was essentially blaming almost entirely psychological factors for the crisis. The story is a very, very simple one. Initially, there were debt products being sold between financial institutions, and these products were dressed up, perhaps because some bankers were opportunistic. Banks essentially trust each other in these products. They think it's safe to buy them because they're all in the same boat, so to speak. But perhaps some bankers were taking larger risks than there should have been. Risk-taking, of course, can then lead to a situation where loans are defaulted, banks are losing money, and so on and so forth. And this led to a crisis of trust, literally trust between individual bankers. This trust meant that bankers and banks wouldn't lend to each other. When banks didn't lend to each other, there was a liquidity crisis, which means that banks generally couldn't afford to lend money to consumers and firms. And this, of course, then means, the point we made earlier on, that consumers suddenly felt the pinch, firms felt the pinch, people didn't have money in their pockets, and then the whole confidence crisis started. So you can see how trust, risk-taking behavior, confidence, all those things have a huge impact. I think often the Chinese like to see themselves as slightly apart from the international financial system. Potentially, they think they're more insulated from these effects. But of course, at the moment, China's economic growth is mainly generated by firms exporting, especially consumer goods, to the West. When our consumers lose confidence and they don't buy, that will impact on Chinese firms, there's no doubt. So what economists often call the real economy in China, the physical economy producing goods and services, could be impacted in this way. So I think, although the financial systems, of course, are slightly separate between the West and China, and separated, eventually the lack of buying power here in the West will hit them, there's no doubt about it.
You mentioned a while ago the idea of the old and the new in China, the consumerism versus the sort of the more traditional values. I mean, when I was in China, we went sort of down to the local market in Ningbo and found a KFC. It's just such a glaring contradiction and surprised me.
Before I went out to China, I had lunch with our former vice chancellor, Sir Colin Campbell, and he basically said to me, in the middle of Ningbo, there's a church, and literally underneath the Catholic church, is a bustling market. And he kind of looked at me, waiting for a response, and of course, it sunk in after a few seconds that in a former socialist state, the idea of suddenly having a church and a market would have been unthinkable only 10, 15 years ago. So this is a sign of how things are changing, and the idea essentially is that perhaps Chinese people now opening up to these ideas are finding new values to believe in. And there's many ways they can go. If you're brought up in a Marxist-Leninist tradition and suddenly these things open up, you could very well go into consumerism, buying branded goods and so on and so forth, buying KFC, buying McDonald's, all those kinds of things. You could go into religion because there's now greater freedom in terms of religion, any form of religion. You might become more aware of the role of China in the world and more strongly believe in perhaps patriotic ideals. And these three things will have a huge impact on how China is a part of the overall global economy. In terms, very simply, of the purchasing patterns, Chinese people will have increasing amounts of money, they will become a large market, and this is going to be significant for Western firms.
I've read a report recently as well that said the vast majority of people in China don't spend, they have the money, they save. You know, for years there's been that sort of psychological, again, influence to save money, get something behind you. And now the government's trying to get them to spend. How do you change that paradigm? How do you change that sort of mental mindset?
Yes, I think it's an excellent point. And the way you phrase it, mental mindset, is exactly how we look at it. We would call it simply culture. Culture not as higher art or civilization, but culture as shared values and beliefs that a group of people have. And Chinese culture is different in exactly the ways that you suggest. In China, Chinese culture is different in two or three ways. One would be Chinese people believe very strongly in authority. So, for instance, older people, people in senior positions are listened to. Filial piety, for instance, is something Westerners are familiar with, that you do listen to your parents no matter how old you are. Secondly, it's different because Chinese people are much more interested in harmony between people. And again, Westerners have heard the Chinese concept of face, where we try to avoid embarrassing someone in public so they lose face. That will undermine the harmony of the group. A completely different facet is, of course, is the value that Chinese society places in education. This is the Confucian ideal. That relates very strongly to saving, because, of course, when education is not public, then families will save a lot of money to afford the education of their children. And because the children are filial, they will, when they're educated, will pass on the fruits of their labor, so to speak, to the older generation. So it's almost a financial investment in the education of children. That basically means there's a higher savings ratio, people save more. This can have negative impacts on business development. People need to save so firms can borrow money to invest in new machines and so on.
I mean, for a capitalist system to work and to be successful and for people to benefit from it, there needs to be an element of competition. And in the West, we've seen ferocious competition. We've seen, we are seeing the results of that. Is that something that can happen in China? It doesn't seem the culture for that level of competition, or are we going to see a new kind of capitalism?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I think many of us tend to think of China as a communist country and a socialist country, and thus, therefore we somehow think of Chinese culture connected to that and perhaps not being capitalistic. But of course, if you look at the so-called diaspora Chinese, i.e. Chinese people who've left China and are now in places like Singapore, for instance, Malaysia, Indonesia, they're extremely entrepreneurial. And there are theories which say that in those countries, the very small minority of Chinese people in those countries actually owns the majority of wealth. So you can see that actually something in the Chinese culture, which predates communism and socialism there, is very beneficial for entrepreneurial activity, for commercialism, for competition. And those Chinese people are exceptionally competitive, not simply commercially competitive, but at a personal level. Excelling in education and in other things is seen as very, very important. And they're extremely industrious. So I don't see any contradiction there. I think the contradiction is in the way in which perhaps socialism was used in China, because that to me seems to be much more at ill ease with Chinese culture and Chinese mentality than perhaps with Western mentalities.
You've been listening to the University of Nottingham podcast. Some of the music in this show has been supplied by the Podshow Podsafe Music Network. That's music.podshow.com. If you'd like to comment on this or any other podcast you've heard, you can add a message on iTunes or simply drop me a line at andrew.burden@nottingham.ac.uk. Thanks for listening.